ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Corbin Middlemass here from ABC Cricket Podcast. There has never been a more anticipated Ashes series than the one going down this summer. Australia versus England is always huge, but this feels generationally massive. A crucial clash needs a comprehensive analysis. So check out ABC Cricket Podcast. Join me and ex-Australia opener Ed Cowan every Monday and Friday, as well as after every day of play for the best conversation in cricket. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Our summer season continues, bringing you the best of Late Night Live in 2025. In the 1950s and 60s, the people of Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Egypt and Israel heard the news and the propaganda of the big powers on radio. We look at the part radio played in the catastrophic post-war politics of the Middle East. But first, from the Middle East today, a moral reckoning. It was still October and Israel had been bombing Gaza for only 3 weeks when Omar el-Akkad tweeted, "One day when it's safe, when there's no personal downside to calling a thing what it is, when it's too late to hold anyone accountable, everyone will always have been against this." 10 million people have read that tweet. Omar is an American citizen, born in Egypt, raised in Qatar and Canada, a journalist on the Globe and Mail for 10 years, these days a novelist and now author of a powerful book of essays provoked by a war he says has shattered his confidence in the West. Has the polite Western liberal, he asks, ever stood for anything at all? His book is called One Day, Everyone Will Always Have Been Against This, and he joins us from Washington. Omar, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
Omar, what brought you to this? What shattered your confidence in the West?
I think since I was about 5 years old, I have oriented myself towards that part of the world. One of the things about growing up in a place like the Middle East is that you're in an environment a lot of the time where it feels a little bit like there's an anvil on your chest in terms of the politics of the place or the governance of the place. I grew up in a country where one of my formative childhood memories is holding up magazines to the light bulb to try and see behind the black ink that the censor had sort of used to wipe out things that were too dangerous for me to read. And when you grow up in that kind of environment, there's always a tendency to sort of superimpose what you need a place to be onto somewhere else. And that's how I thought of the West. It wasn't so much what the West was as what it wasn't. You know, I could go there and there would be no censored magazines. There would be no censored books. And I think part and parcel of that belief is the belief that there are these underlying principles that hold the place up, equal justice, equal rights, so on and so forth. And I think for the majority of my life, regardless of what I saw around me, especially during those 10 years when I was a reporter, I could compartmentalize any amount of ugliness I saw, and I could put it in a silo and say, this is a one-off, this is a one-off. And I think over the last year and a half, I've become unable to do that. I've woken up every day for the last year and a half, and I've opened up my computer or turned on my TV screen and seen evidence of the worst things human beings can do to one another. And I know that my tax dollars are paying for it. I know that I am doing that thing. And so that has sort of shattered my capacity to compartmentalize the things that I'd seen previously and to say, you know, despite this all, there is something underlying all of this that is both good and load-bearing. I think that's what's changed.
I'm very interested in the way you position discussion of Gaza with discussion of the conquest of North America. Is it because you see Gaza as an essentially Western colonial enterprise?
You know, I'm not a particularly clever person, and so I resort to pattern recognition a lot of the time. And when I was sort of making that comparison, which I think happened several times in the book, I was thinking in terms of those patterns, because I live in a part of the world where, particularly in terms of narrative, I've heard it before, this idea that there are savages on the other side of this gate, and that any amount of violence is justified because it's protecting civilization from the barbarians. And I've heard these things over and over and over again. And so it makes it quite difficult for me to think of something like the last year and a half of slaughter in Gaza, which is coming on the back of three quarters of a century of occupation, and not see this the same narrative devices employed over and over again. The problem, I think, particularly in this moment, is that that narrative framing, no matter how compelling it may be, and no matter how much it sort of offsets someone's obligation to oppose a thing that they would otherwise absolutely oppose, is that it's up against an endless stream of news and video and audio of children being massacred. And I don't know that there's any narrative device on earth that can stand up to that and make that okay. But when I was sort of thinking about it, I was thinking about the narrative constructions around this part of the world where I live, North America, and how easy it was to do this, how easy it was to label the inconvenient other as an inherently savage population against which anything is permissible, and how equally easy it is in hindsight, after the fact, to be deeply apologetic about all of that. And I think that's the reason I called the book what I did.
You've reported on war. War's not unfamiliar to you. But it seems, as well as losing your faith in Western values at this moment, you've also lost faith in the ground rules of journalism about the notion of being the disinterested, the neutral observer of what's going on in front of you.
I'm not sure if I agree or disagree with that. I'm genuinely not. And the reason I say that is because, you know, journalism's the only real job I had. It was also my education. It was a writing education. It was an education in the world. I adore journalists. I think they do incredibly important work. And I think the vast majority of the time, they are trying their best under incredibly difficult circumstances. I mean, you know, I don't need to tell you or anyone who's ever been in this profession any of this, but nobody gets into this for the money. Or the fame, or the great working hours. You know, there's a reason journalism has one of the highest divorce rates of any profession. I think for me, one of the things that has become sort of crystal clear, particularly over the last year and a half, is that the traditional notion of a journalist as a sort of impartial observer who, you know, gets a quote from person A and gets a quote from person B and puts it down on paper or reports it in some way. All of that works really, really well when the playing field is level and when all the actors are acting in good faith. Once those prerequisites aren't there, that same mode of journalism to me becomes not just sort of delinquent, but deeply destructive. I mean, I live here in the U.S. where we have NPR, you know, National Public Radio. And I was driving home one night a couple of weeks ago, and there was this interview with an expert on Medicare. Over here right now, the Republican administration is trying to gut Medicare. And the interviewer said something like, well, there's this Republican lawmaker who says that 50% of expenditures in Medicare are fraud. What do you have to say to that? And the thing about that is that that's a completely fantastical number that has no relationship to reality. It's an outright lie. And so this expert said something like, look, We don't have any evidence to suggest that 50% of this is fraud. We have evidence to suggest that 5% is error, billing errors. And then the reporter said something like, well, you say 5%, this lawmaker says 50%. Is there not a middle ground there?
Oh, God.
And right? I mean, I'm listening yes. to this thinking, this is the model of journalism that I was brought up on, that so many reporters have some variant of you know, they're allegiant to some variant of it. And I'm watching it fall apart in real time. And I don't think it's because this reporter's a bad person. I think the prerequisites for that kind of journalism simply aren't there. I don't know that any traditional journalistic model has ever really figured out a good way to call out a complete and total and malicious lie. And then that's where I think the model is falling apart.
The model also for the reporting of this war has fallen apart, has it not? I mean, does the Globe and Mail have a correspondent embedded with the Israel Defense Forces? Does the New York Times?
That's an interesting question. In the case of the Globe and Mail, I suspect that we don't have a Middle East correspondent anymore. And I think that was a budget thing that happened long ago. And I also suspect that this is the case with a lot of newspapers that have had to shut down their foreign bureaus. And of course, again, I don't need to tell you this, but there's a couple of things that happen once you take that step. One is that you're reliant on you know, other people's reporting, which of course you can't vet nearly as well. But the other is that you lose the element of expertise of a person being in the place. You know, I've done both those kinds of reporting. When I was in Afghanistan, I went out on my own. I say on my own, that's actually a very cowardly and untrue way to put it. I went out with a fixer who actually knew what the hell he was doing.
Yes, we know those. We know those wonderful men and women.
Right. I mean, this person used to be a doctor and he was making more money assisting a random reporter. But that's, you know, that's a different story, I suppose.
But
I went up with him.
That's one aspect of it. But the aspect that I was more interested in getting at is that, you know, in reporting the Vietnam War, in reporting the Second World War, United States forces had journalists embedded with them. They watched, they were there at the battlefront. That does not seem to be the model in Gaza.
Yeah, so this is what I was getting at, right? Is, you know, I'd go out on my own and I'd see something, and then I'd go out with the troops and I would see something else entirely. One of the central ways in which a population turns on an unjust war is that they simply see it for what it is. And in the case of Gaza, you have an incredible throttling of that. And it's doubly bad because, first off, your Western correspondents can't get in there. And a lot of the times they are embedded with the military and they're going through the military censor, and you're getting an incredibly torqued version of events as a result. But then on top of that, the Palestinian journalists who are actually doing the work, and in many cases risking and in fact giving their lives to do this work, have the work be immediately discounted because it's coming from them, which to me is a patently racist notion, but nonetheless it exists, at least in the part of the world I live in. So it's not just that you're not getting news out of there. It's that you're not getting news from people who are determined in advance to be sufficient couriers of that news. We're getting lots of news out of Gaza. The reason it doesn't tend to make a lot of the broadcasts in my part of the world is because it's inherently and immediately considered suspect on account of the ethnicity and nationality of the people doing the reporting.
Do you think Israel's argument would be better heard, better respected, if it did allow traditional news sources to observe what was happening and to report without censorship?
I doubt it very much. I mean, again, every morning for the last year and a half, I've woken up and I've seen the most horrific things. You know, I heard a 5 or 6 year old girl beg for her life. shortly before soldiers shot her car at least 355 times. I don't know how you become, how you remain the same person on the other side of that. I genuinely don't know. But I'm also cognizant of the reality that in the country I live in, there is an immense privilege to not see any of that, to not hear any of that, to be protected from it. And I genuinely don't know what would happen if that information was regularly on the nightly news that millions of Americans watch every night. I can't imagine a situation in which independent reporters are allowed into a killing field, report from the killing field, and then that bolsters the argument of the entity doing most of the killing. I simply can't see that happening. But it's a hypothetical point, regardless, because it's not being allowed.
This is Late Night Live on Radio National, and I'm talking to Omar El Akkad, journalist, novelist, author of a brilliant book of essays called One Day Everyone Will Always Have Been Against This. Let's focus, if we can, on why you blame Western values for this violence in the Middle East. For instance, it does not strike me, for instance, that Donald Trump is an embodiment of Western liberalism.
So I live in Portland, Oregon, which is one of the most sort of performatively liberal places you will ever visit. I often say it's the kind of town where you'll go into a neighborhood where every house has a lawn sign that says Black Lives Matter, and there's not a single Black family, you know, within 10 miles in any direction. My issue isn't with liberalism in a vacuum. My issue is with the chasm between the performance of liberalism and the reality, especially as I have witnessed it over the last year and a half. I have had so many conversations last year with people begging me to vote Democrat anyway, because yes, it's all very bad what's happening over there, but you know, Trump is going to be worse. And of course I know Trump is going to be worse. And to be perfectly honest with you, I don't care whether he embodies Western liberalism or not. I don't care in the slightest. I don't have the privilege to care because I have to survive the next 4 years. And I genuinely can't tell you what's going to happen next week, let alone a year or two or four from now. The difference, I think, between something like the Trump administration and the administration that came before is that there's a much smaller gap between the performance and the reality. You know, I spent a year listening to White House and State Department spokespeople talk about how much this government is doing for the Palestinian people and this desire for a lasting peace, as all the while the same government was sending over the missiles that were responsible for this carnage, that were being used in this carnage. Someone like Donald Trump does away with a lot of that. And so there's a smaller gap between the performance and the reality. I don't know how much he wants to embody liberalism or has any interest in that kind of conversation. I do know that I have no idea what the entrenched resistance to that looks like, because in this country, there are two political parties. There's the Democrats and the Republicans. Those are the only two that have any shot at federal leadership. And one of those is behaving like a fascist cult, and the other can't muster the resistance to it. I'm watching Democratic lawmakers wear pink suit jackets to the State of the Union address. That's their mode of resistance. If that is the personification of liberalism, I'm not sure I have a use for it.
Isn't the chasm between decent values and horrid outcomes politics, that this is where the political machines operate? This is where, amongst other things, the superb political organization of the Israeli state comes into play. and in a purely technical way, it's kind of almost admirable, the skill, the power of the Israeli state. I mean, we see it in Australia, and it's very evident in America. Doesn't that have to be factored in to an argument about moral failure?
I don't know that I can disagree with a word of that. There were many times when I was writing this book where I thought to myself, you know, grow up. This is politics. This is just how things are done. This is the great game, whatever you want to call it. And I think as sort of morally allergic as I might be to what you just described, most of the time, I can sit with that argument. Because again, this is how politics is done. And you know, it's clearly, the evidence is clear that this is effective. It's not just effective when Israel does it. It's effective when any country does it well or any entity does it well, you know, individually or institutionally. I think, again, the difference here is that the mode we have to be operating in has to allow me to be that pragmatic and to think in terms of real politics or however you want to describe it. And when I've just seen a kid shot in the head, I can't operate in that mode. Well, it's not so much that I disagree with you that this kind of stuff is effective. I just don't know what remains effective after watching a kid get killed. That's what it's up against. And honestly, I can't tell you if this book I've written is any good. I can't tell your listeners to go buy it or anything like that. And maybe it's not worth a damn. But I don't know that someone as inherently conflict averse and frankly as cowardly as I am would have written something like this under different circumstances, precisely because of what you're describing, because I know how the world works. I get it. But this isn't that moment. It just isn't, because no matter what political or rhetorical device you throw at me, it is not going to compare to the weight and to the impact of watching a child get killed and knowing that I killed that kid, that my tax dollars did that.
What can the West do?
I think one of the things I keep coming back to is that as disillusioned as I've been, as I've become about the West institutionally, and I mean political institutions, journalistic, cultural, you name it, I have been so incredibly inspired by what people are doing individually and in solidarity with one another. I keep coming back to these images of these college kids who are risking their livelihoods, risking their futures to protest on their college campuses on behalf of a people who can offer them nothing in return. I keep looking at images of people chaining themselves to the gates of weapons manufacturers, of dock workers refusing to load the missiles onto ships. I'm incredibly inspired by what people in this part of the world are doing, in spite of immense institutional odds and resistance. And I think that's what's happening right now. It's not so much what can the West do, it's what's being done right now. And I think, you know, change comes very, very slowly. My previous newspaper in the middle of last year refused to run an op-ed in which I called this a genocide and said Western governments are complicit. And in January, they agreed to run an op-ed in which I called this a genocide and said Western governments are complicit. What changed? I have no idea. Probably people much braver than me have been doing the pushing. But something is changing, and I think it's changing because people are willing to stand up and be troublesome about this, despite the fact that, especially where I live, it is so much easier to just look away. There's almost no consequences to it. And yet people are doing the opposite. And so I think you know, I have no place to tell people what to do or not do, but what people are doing right now is making a difference, albeit very, very slowly, and as the body count continues to rise.
Is this why you call the book a stone-cold bummer of a book, but profoundly hopeful?
Yeah, I mean, look, man, I write really depressing books anyway. The novels weren't much better.
That's not what the critics say.
I was told that my books make good book club books because the people who dislike them really hate them. And so it makes for good discussion, you know? I mean, this is as depressing a book as it is. I think it's the most hopeful thing I've ever written because, again, I'm not a particularly courageous person. I leech courage where I can find it. And I found it in so many places and among so many people. And I'm deeply hopeful that we will be on the other side of this moment and that something far, far better than this is possible.
Omar, thank you. I've been talking to Omar El Akkad, who is the author of One Day Everyone Will Always Have Been Against This, published in Australia by that fine publishing house, Text. Coming up, radio propaganda in the 50s and 60s in the Middle East. Until the war of 1967, radio was everything in the Middle East. Newspapers didn't circulate widely, TV was rare. The people of Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, and Israel heard the news and the propaganda of the big powers on radio. As well as players like the BBC, hundreds of little stations across the region were pumping out propaganda. What began as a relatively modest program in the 1940s ballooned, says my guest today, Margaret Peacock, ballooned into a leviathan of sound stretching across the dial, running day and night. And the upshot, she says, was disastrous. Margaret Peacock is a professor of history at the University of Alabama. Her new book about all of this is called Frequencies of Deceit: How Global Propaganda Wars Shaped the Middle East. Margaret, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Margaret, have I got this right? While the powers were arguing about who should run the show, they were essentially all putting out a vision of a secular, modern, free Middle East.
Yeah. It starts off relatively modest. In the late 40s, early 50s, it really is just the BBC and Radio Moscow that are broadcasting, on the big dials on the international radio. The BBC is also joined by the Near East Arab Broadcasting Station and the Palestinian Broadcasting Service, all of which are coming from Whitehall. Despite the fact that both Britain and the Soviet Union are coming from increasingly diametric ideological positions, right from the get-go, they're both making pretty strong arguments, for their particular way of doing things, their particular agendas in the Middle East, and they're doing it in surprisingly similar ways.
How did they respond to the rise of Israel, to the independence of Israel or the creation of the state in 1948?
That's a great question. I think I make the argument in the book that the first betrayal happens, for Arab listeners, the first betrayal happens with the UN vote and the creation of the State of Israel. Britain, which had controlled the Palestinian mandate up to that point, made this sort of, well, you're going to regret kicking us out kind of argument. The Soviets made the argument over the year that they supported the Palestinian cause, but we all know how they voted on the floor of the UN. The United States wasn't really involved. The United States actually chose to sort of stay silent over the air in the early 50s, partially because they didn't trust radio yet. They saw radio and propaganda as inherently sort of totalitarian, bad projects. They will come around. They will come around. But also because they themselves were great defenders and crusaders for the creation of the State of Israel, and thought that anything they had to say or there would probably go badly for them. But there were promises made over the air that Arab populations believed were pretty inviolable, that ultimately, of course, ended with the creation of the State of Israel. And it sort of is the first brick in the wall, I guess, the first moment of real sense of betrayal from the Arab world that comes up over the Arab, over the radio waves.
But for the Arab world, at least, your book charts betrayals, lies, disappointment, all the way to the 1967 war. Is that accurate?
It is. There's been a good bit of scholarship, really great scholarship, written on some of the key facets of the propaganda project in the Middle East in the 1950s, particularly from the British side. There have been some great scholars who've done that work. There have been nobody who's looked at the Soviet stuff, nobody who's looked at the stuff coming out of Radio Moscow, and nobody who's really looked at the material coming out of the Middle East, particularly out of Radio Cairo, Voice of the Arabs. What you see when you triangulate all of these broadcasts, and I think I was arguably the first person to go beyond looking in the organizational archives and to really look at the actual transcripts of what was getting said over the air day after day. When you triangulate all of these broadcasts and you put them into conversation with each other, which is as terrifying and gargantuan a task as I'm sure you can imagine.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, what you find is that it's really a terrifying story of empty promises made on the backs of promises of secular liberation, modernity, development. Whether it's coming from the communist camp, whether it's coming from the socialist camp, or it's coming from the capitalist camp, all the stations argued that they were able to bring happiness, modernity, development, education, culture, peace to their populations. All of them, to one extent or another, embraced a pretty Orientalist framework in doing it.
What do you mean by that, Margaret, an Orientalist framework?
Based on a foundation of belief that the Middle East is some kind of an other, right? That it represents a...
It's exotic.
An exotic, right? The non-Occident. It represents something, yeah, it represents something that needs to be civilized in one form or another, or is inherently locked in very specific kind of backward ways of understanding the world. All of these broadcasters claimed that they had a monopoly on the truth. All of them pitched a narrative that they were going to somehow be able to save the Middle East, you know, if only the Arabic-speaking listeners would, you know, embrace one side or the other. All of it, of course, steeped in a larger Cold War agenda that just gets increasingly stronger as the years pass. All of it, of course, centralized around this message about peace, right, that everyone's interested in peace. But, of course, people arguing that war is a, you know, that peace can be a justification for war. And this just continues, right? And interestingly, they're all in conversation with each other. So one of the arguments I make in the book is that these broadcasters are not all working in silos. They're actually all really clearly paying attention to what everyone else is saying over the air, and then in constant conversation with each other, responding to each other. This echo chamber evolving over time.
I got the feeling from the book that they were talking to each other as much as they were talking to the to the population of the Middle East, and perhaps even more so to each other than the population of the Middle East.
Yeah, terrifyingly, I think you're right. They would never have said that. They would have said that they were speaking to a targeted population, that they were interested in, bringing over to their ideological side or their neo-colonial side. They would have argued that they were fighting for humanitarian causes or for the liberty of their listening populations. But in reality, it's really clear when you listen to these transcripts that even if they believed they were talking directly to their listeners, what they were choosing to talk about was largely determined by the people they were hearing on the other places on the dial.
What was Britain's dog in the fight once the mandate of Palestine ended in 1948? Why was Britain still in there?
Well, Britain still had a lot of strategic interests in the Middle East after the Palestinian mandate ended. Obviously, they had significant interests in Suez, and that leads to the Suez debacle in 1956. But after Suez, there still are significant British interests, if not just to maintain position within the larger Cold War geostrategic space, but also, to maintain control in Aden, right, and the other parts of the Middle East that still held really key British bases,
British military. Of course, yes, Aden, the Suez Canal. And for America, was it more than just a battleground for the Cold War?
I'm not the only historian to say this, but the United States really was locked into these Cold War blinders that made it really difficult for them to think beyond sort of the Moscow space, even when the evidence was there that Moscow was not, significantly involved, for instance, in influencing Nasser, who was the president of Cairo. Even if, even when we see instances where, a more measured approach would have made a lot more strategic sense, the United States embraces the Eisenhower policy. They embrace, the putting of soldiers on the ground in Syria, or at least attempted on the ground in Syria in 57, and then in Lebanon in 58. And in each of these instances, American involvement, and Iran, let's not forget Iran in 53, which plays a big role in how the Middle Eastern populations think about the United States early on. In all of those instances, we see a drive to, by the United States to put in regimes that are friendly to the West, friendly to their economic interests, to their oil interests,
wouldn't think of trying to take away their oil holdings. I mean, what was Iran thinking, Margaret?
Right. It would have been unheard of, right, for people to actually claim control over their own natural resources.
Exactly. But tell us about the rise of Egyptian radio. So in a sense, it's quite easy to visualize the role of Britain and Moscow and America. But what was Egyptian radio like? And I get a sense from the book that Egyptian radio was actually much more entertaining than the BBC or the Voice of America or what was coming out of Moscow. That it was actually, Radio Moscow. It might have been quite fun to listen to.
Oh, no, famously so. Radio Moscow knew that it had a problem. It knew that we've all heard the horrible Bolshevik speak that would come out of, the standard sort of Bolshevik language that would come out of the Soviet Union. Everyone made fun of it. That was a problem that the Soviets were aware of that they needed to work on. The Americans were aware of it too, although they were so nervous about hiring native Egyptian Arabic speakers that they just continued to be a lame duck on the air. They famously would have bad signals that would go for days, or they would have people who clearly didn't actually speak Arabic reading Arabic over the air, or they would leave a record going after it had finished playing and it would just scratch at the center over and over and over again. Meanwhile, Egyptian radio was, incredibly exciting. Nasser and his sort of number one broadcaster, a man named Ahmed Said, stylistically, they mobilized every modern propaganda trick in the book in ways that entirely surpassed their rivals on the dial. For instance, they would repeat key phrases. Ahmed Said famously had a catchphrase imagine, O Arabs, and he would say it over, he would repeat it over and over again. Their message was openly pro-Nasserist, committed to Arab unity and support for Palestine. It was anti-imperialist, starting with Britain as the target and then evolving into an anti-American message by the late 1950s. And then reinforcing, you know, the offense taken at Britain's aggression and the promises of the Nasserist project for the Arab world. It's just really, really exciting. And it's not surprising that Ahmed Said and Voice of the Arabs became the station that everyone else worked to emulate.
On Late Night Live, my guest is Margaret Peacock, the professor of history at the University of Alabama and author of this absolutely intriguing book, Frequencies of Deceit, How Global Propaganda Wars Shaped the Middle East. Now, I want to interrupt the narrative here, Margaret, to ask about the research you did. Because, I mean, radio, I'm not saying this of Late Night Live, but radio goes out into the air and is often, well, is usually just forgotten. How were you able to investigate what was broadcast in 1948 or 1953 or indeed 1962?
You ask a really good question with significant difficulty. Back in those days, and I don't know how much of your broadcasting is scripted, but back in these days,
people very little.
Well, back then it was pretty well scripted, particularly when it was state-run. So state-run radio would be very carefully written and scripted before a broadcaster would read it. In fact, it would be written in the native tongue. It would be written in English or Russian. And then it would be, in the Soviet case, it would go through censors. Then it would go back for rewriting. Then once it had gotten past that round, it would get transcribed into Arabic. And then in the Soviet case, it would be looked at by censors again because they want to make sure that the Arabic speakers haven't squirreled something in there that yes. that wasn't approved. And then once it had gotten approved, it would then go to the broadcasters who would read it over the air from transmission stations and then sent off to the Middle East and you know really across the Levant and North Africa. So the upshot to that is that a lot of that stuff did get written down. The downside is that both the Arab radio, Voice of the Arabs, and the Voice of America, which starts broadcasting in 1953 in Arabic, those archives have been destroyed. The Voice of America archive was destroyed in a fire, and the Voice of the Arabs archives transcripts were destroyed on purpose when Nasser died. So I then had to figure out how to get a hold of those transcripts, even though those transcripts had been destroyed. It turns out that everybody might, and by the way, the British were great. They just kept a track. They kept a record of everything that they
God
said.
God bless
kept,
them. Yes, of course.
But it turns out that everybody was listening to each other really carefully, particularly the BBC monitoring service was listening to everyone, and they had armies of people who were literally writing down transcripts, transcribing the stuff that they were hearing getting said around the world. And then that stuff would get, those transcripts would get summarized and then sent to Whitehall to help sort of, you know, with British foreign policy decision making. And in the United States, the CIA was doing the same thing. They listened really carefully to Voice of the Arabs. In fact, I think they wrote down everything that Ahmed Said ever said over the air, the CIA. They were listening pretty carefully to Radio Moscow. There were some lovely moments when I came across the same transcript of the same broadcast in the Russian archives in Moscow and in the CIA archives.
And you could check them against each other.
And you could check them against each other of course, the Russian archives, of course, those are all in Russian and the American ones are all in English, but they all were actually transmitted in Arabic.
How many years were you digging through all of this material?
I think it was all in all about 5 years of work. And thankfully, I was able to get the Russian research done, before the war began and before it became untenable for researchers to go to Moscow.
Has the war closed the archives in Moscow?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. There are no Western scholars going to Moscow now.
Now, you end the book in 1967. Why is 1967 your end date, and what is the role in all of this of Ahmed Said?
I did so much research. I actually did enough research to go up to 1979, to the Iranian hostage crisis. But at this point, I had written 350 pages, and my editor said, absolutely not. You're not allowed to go
aren't
any
they,
longer.
Aren't they narrow? They're so narrow-minded, those editors, aren't they?
Nobody wants to read a 500-page book about this stuff. So I actually had to cut the book way back. It's not 350 pages now, believe me. It's a readable size. But I actually have enough material to write a second volume, so feel free to call me.
We will.
Any press
we will, interested. We will. But 1967, from your
but
argument.
But 67, why 67? Yeah. I'll tell you. It's because of the Six-Day War. You know, most people remember those 6 days in June 1967 as a moment. You can talk to pretty much anyone who was alive in Egypt in 1967 or really in the Middle East in 1967, and they will talk to you about the radio because during those 6 days of war, Ahmed Said was on the air the whole time, and he continued to repeat the story that the Egyptian army was winning and that the Israelis were on the run. Then he told the story that American and British bombers were actually bombing Arab targets. All of it was a lie, right? We know this. We know that all of it was a lie. And by the end of those 6 days in June 1967, everyone else knew that it was a lie. Everyone else knew that Ahmed Said had been lying to them. You know, famously, the lie was so convincing that on the fourth day of the war, when Israeli troops were within spitting distance of Alexandria, there were people still out, you know, doing their afternoon shopping and sitting in cafes in Cairo, entirely convinced that the war was won, and they were celebrating in the streets. And that was because this lie that Ahmed Said told was so, so convincing. And there's no doubt that these lies were lies. And in the last chapter of the book, I basically triangulated all of the transcripts coming from all of the broadcasters, and I actually put them into conversation with each other on the page. So you can go to that last chapter and just read, you know, here's what the BBC says. 10 seconds later, here's what Radio Cairo has to say up
yes.
the dial. And,
yes.
and the idea was to try to replicate what it would have felt like to sit at a radio in Cairo and turn the dial and just listen, you know, to what's getting said. And what you find is a cacophony of completely contradictory information.
Sounds a bit familiar, Margaret.
Massive waves. Sorry?
It sounds a bit familiar.
Right.
But so by 67, the BBC, the Voice of America, and Moscow Radio was boring everybody. And
The BBC had kind of recovered by 67.
Right.
The BBC used, you know, its cachet was that it told the truth, good or bad. It had kind of faltered in 56. By backing away from that and at some key moments during the Suez Crisis. But by 67, people are still tuning into the BBC to listen, but not if they're listening to Ahmed Said, who's just far more interesting.
And he's now been revealed to be a liar. So that the whole,
right.
if I got your argument right, the whole sort of radio enterprise comes unstuck at this point. And
yes.
so does the message of modernity and liberty.
Yeah.
What's the response in the Arab world to that?
Every historian is always hunting for the smoking gun. And I really do think I got as close as I could to finding it. There really was some pretty clear evidence that this lie, this what they called the big lie, that victory had been attained, that promised victory of 67, you know, had behind it the promise of the Nasserist project, the promise of the Nasserist secular modernist project.
It had behind,
it had behind it this grand promise, right? That Nasser was going to transform the Middle East into this grand pan-Arab, you know, powerhouse. When those lies were revealed, it revealed, you know, a house of cards. And the truth was that Nasser's regime was crumbling in a lot of key ways, even, you know, by 67. And the truth was that people felt ultimately very betrayed by this. You know, I was able to find some pretty incredible evidence that Arab listeners just decided that they were done being disillusioned with these secular promises. The other big key takeaway from this, right, is that Nasser and Ahmed Said were not the only ones lying. The truth was that everybody had been lying now at this point for decades. It's not as though Ahmed Said bears the burden of this betrayal on his own shoulders all by himself. He was lying because there was no other way to talk. Everything was false. The language of the radio had become entirely untethered from people's experiences, their real experiences on the ground. And when the truth stops being told, when the language around you stops reflecting the experience that you're actually having in your life, you start looking somewhere else for truth. And the argument, at least that I make, is that this collapse of language, this collapse of these promises of liberation and peace and happiness and modernity, that collapse played a key role in urging people to look towards political Islam as a more authentic path for state building, for community building.
But surely that was also influenced by the sensational victory of the Israelis in 1967. I mean, that is in military history an astonishing victory. So that you had to look somewhere else entirely at that point. And so you look to the mullahs.
Well, you look to other sources of language that feel more authentic, right? You look to other sources of language that don't seem to be lying to you all the time.
And so you turn away from modernity back to tradition.
Yeah, or you turn back to anything that feels more authentic. Well, on the one hand, we can sit in judgment of that, and we know that the consequences of that haven't all been authenticity and honesty either. Somehow power seems to breed this. But if we're trying to, I think one of the arguments that I make in the book that it might be salient for us now is that, if you're trying to understand why the Palestinian peace process has failed year after year after year, decade after decade, a part of the answer to that is that decades of using empty language where you say words that don't mean anything anymore. When you talk about peace, but you don't mean peace. You talk about liberation, but you don't mean liberation. Everything comes with strings attached. It's all empty political language. As long as the Palestinian peace process is hemmed to that old, tired echo chamber of language, it's never going to be able to get out of it. When people stop using authentic language, they stop remembering how to use it. They stop remembering that ever it existed in the first place. And you end up sort of getting stuck in these mantras of repeated emptiness.
Margaret,
not to end with something really dark, but there you go. Mm-hmm.
What do you see is the lesson for us today from this time back then, the Middle East post-war?
I mean, it's a tough question. People talk now about how we live in a post-truth world, right? This language has been around. This term has been around now for almost a decade. People talk about we inhabit the post-truth world. We have political leaders who feel no obligation to have their language be tethered to the truth any longer. Belief and fact are synonymous with each other. You can make something real just by believing that it's real. You can make claims that aren't founded in evidence. And if you just say it hard enough and fast enough and angrily enough, people will just accept it. We live in a world now where artificial intelligence is happy to just fabricate language for us in these stale mantras of, again, repeated emptiness. And, there's a cost to this. I mean, I think, if anything, we look back to what happened over the air in the Middle East in the 1950s, and we see what can be done. We see what can happen when populations no longer can look with respect to the conveyance of authoritative information and trust that it's real. Being lied to, there's a cost to that.
Margaret, thank you. And that's the show. On our next, an urgent question for our time. Why do societies collapse? I'm talking to Cambridge scholar Luke Kemp, student of failed empires. And we're looking at a new history of trade unions in Australia. Solidarity? Maybe. Forever? Well, we're not so sure.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.